I want to start with verse 11. We're at chapter 37. Remember, Joseph has had two dreams. He told them to his brothers. Then he tells them to his brothers and his father. In the dreams, all his brothers bow down to him. And then in the second dream, his brothers and his father and mother bow down to him. They're the stars, and his father and mother are the sun and the moon. And of course, he has essentially the universe bowing down to him, which is an extravaganza of youthful grandiosity. Remember that the truth is that your parents, when you're young, your parents are the sun and the moon, right? The world does revolve around them. And there is a sort of infantile narcissism, right? That the world revolves around you because they're, but he's 17. So maybe it's telling us that he hasn't outgrown that sense that everything revolves around him. Anyway, like the rest of us have. Okay, so I want to start with verse 11 because it says, so his brothers were wrought up at him, they were upset at him. And then it says that his father, shamar et hadavar. Shamar is to guard, but also to keep in mind. And it doesn't say, what did he keep in mind? Did he keep in mind that Joseph dreamed this dream? Or did he keep in mind that the brothers were upset at him? Or did he keep both in mind? And that's going to be actually a crucial point to try to figure out what it was that Jacob noticed. Because as you know, parents don't always interpret the conflicts between siblings correctly. And so we don't know what it was that Jacob kept in mind, but the reason that it's important is because of what follows. Okay. One time his brothers had gone to pasture their father's flock at Shechem. And remember, we talked about why they went to Shechem, because that was the site of their last triumph with the rape of Dinah and so on, and where they felt like they were in control of the world. So they run off to Shechem because they are bothered by the favoritism at home. At least that's one possible interpretation. And also notice that in contrast to the report in verse 2, Joseph tended the flocks with his brothers. Now he's not. Just what, 10 verses ago, they were all tending the flocks together. Why isn't he going with them? Is it because A, they don't want him? Because B, he feels it's beneath his job description to go tend the flocks with his brothers now? Or is it because his father keeps him at home either to protect him or because he favors him? Lots of possibilities here, right? It may just be that he doesn't want him to get his hands dirty, right? So I don't know the answer to that. But whatever the reason that he doesn't go initially, then it says, Vayomer Yisrael, and here it uses the word Israel and not Jacob, and we'll talk about why in a minute. Your brothers are pasturing at Shechem. And then he says, Lecha ve'eshalcha aleihem. Lecha, they translate as come, I will send them to you, but lecha can also mean go, right? So in which case he's saying, go and I'll send them to you. So some of the going is under Joseph's, some of the going is Joseph's own initiative, and some of it is Jacob's initiative. And how does Joseph answer? Hineni. Now, Hineni has a long pedigree in the Bible. That's what Abraham says when God calls him for the Akedah. And it's what Shmuel says when God calls him to take over the leadership of the temple. It's the statement of, I'm ready to do what is asked of me, and gives us some hint, some possible hint, that Joseph knows that this is going to be more than just checking on his brothers at Shechem, that this is some kind of mission, right? The nature of which he can't know. But what, of course, is most problematic about all this is if Jacob knows that the brothers hate him, if he really shamar et hadavar, if he noticed and kept the matter in mind, then why in the world is he sending Joseph off to Shechem, which is far away, to the brothers who hate him, to check on them, which in and of itself is something that's going to cause resentment, right? Because he could be as much as saying, go spy on your brothers, which is why, remember, they hated him in the first place, because he was spying on them. So is it that Jacob is getting back at Joseph? He has some unconscious or conscious resentment, because what father likes to hear that his son says, "You're bowing down to me"? You know, it's one thing. I remember my oldest brother, Steve, and I remember the day that Steve got very upset because he noticed that he was taller than my father. I remember this very well. And I remember my father saying to him, "No father is ever upset that their son is taller than they are." But Steve didn't say, "And by the way, you're bowing down to me," in which case my father might have had a slightly different reaction and said, "You know, you're going too far, kid." Here, it's not inconceivable that Jacob, who after all has lived a long life already, done a lot of things and achieved a lot, feels dissed by his own kid and thinks, "Maybe I'll send him to the brothers, they'll teach him a little bit of a lesson." It's possible. And that might explain if that's true. And this is, again, this is a big leap. There are a lot of assumptions bound up in this, and it may not be true. But if that's true, that could explain one of the most puzzling things in the book of Genesis, which is why, if Joseph was for decades the viceroy of Egypt, did he never send a messenger back to Canaan and tell his father that he was okay? And that's a very puzzling thing. But maybe Joseph felt like his father deliberately sent him into danger. It's possible. There are other possible explanations, but at least it's worth keeping in mind. So he sends him off to the brothers. And the reason, by the way, I said we're going to return to the idea that to why he's called Israel here instead of Jacob, the usual explanation is that Jacob is called Israel when he functions in terms of the people, and he's called Jacob when he functions as an individual. And this moment is going to be crucial for the history of Israel. Sending him off is going to leads to enslavement in Egypt, ultimate liberation. So this act was a pivot of history. He's really acting as Israel and not as Jacob. Of course, if that's true, then you get the question that we ask over and over again, which is how much of this is personal responsibility and how much of this is determined by God, right? Because if Joseph had to be sold into slavery and Jacob is acting as Israel, then you can't blame Israel for doing it. He was supposed to do it. It's all predetermined, which is why, by the way, even if the Jews did kill Jesus, which they didn't, they shouldn't be blaming us, because Jesus had to die or there'd be no Christianity. So it was, in fact, we should say, "Yes, we did it. You're welcome." Right? Doesn't that make sense? I don't know. It makes sense to me. I don't understand what... it's almost like Jules Pfeiffer had a great cartoon years ago about... and the end of it was... Jesus died for our sins. How dare we make his martyrdom meaningless by not committing them? So, anyway... all right, so, but anyway, the point is of all this, that if in fact Joseph had to be sold into slavery, was it Israel's doing? And the usual answer from the commentators is, God has lots of ways of accomplishing what God chooses to accomplish. It doesn't take away individuals' responsibility. God would have gotten us to Egypt one way or another. Joseph didn't actually have to be mistreated by his brothers in order to do it, although God used that opportunity. So the brothers still get the blame, and it's still, and God still prosecutes his design. Okay, so, and he said to him, "Go now and see how your brothers are and how the flocks are faring, and bring me back word." Vahashiveni davar, is a loaded word in the Bible in general. But also, remember before that he brings back word diba. It is from, let's see, what verse is it? When he says, come on. Where is it that he's gossiping about them? There it is. It's verse 2. Same chapter. Et dibatam ra'a el avihem. So last time he brings back to his father a bad word, and so it seems like that's what Jacob is asking him to do again. Let me know if they're, you know, if they're pasturing properly or they're wasting their time. I don't know what it is that shepherds would be doing when they should be pasturing their flock, but you got to assume that the pasturing a flock is work, and they could be, you know, I don't know, entertaining themselves with the locals. Who knows what they would be doing? The problem, of course, so he sent them from the valley of Hebron, and it says, Vayavo Shechema, and he reached Shechem, but he doesn't know where they are, and Shechem is big enough. I mean, you come to a city, you don't know where 12 people are, or 11, I guess 10 people, and flocks. So he has to find them. Now, the assumption that Jacob makes is that somehow Joseph will succeed in finding them, but it's not to be taken for granted. And what happens is where most commentators see God's intervention, okay? Because when he comes to Shechem, he comes upon a man, right? V'hine to'e basadeh, and behold, he's wandering in the fields. And it doesn't say who's wandering in the fields. It could be the man wandering in the fields, or it could be Joseph wandering in the fields. But either way, when he comes to Shechem, he happens upon this man. And here, let's say he didn't find this guy. He might not have found the brothers. He might have gone home, said, I didn't find them, and the whole thing would be over. But because he comes upon this guy, who is never named in the Bible, everything happens. So the man asked him, what are you looking for? Ma tivakesh. Tivakesh literally means, what are you asking for? But what are you looking for is a good idiomatic translation. And again, especially Hasidic commentaries make a great deal of this. What is it that Joseph's looking for? He doesn't say, who are you looking for? He says, what are you looking for? Right? And this is an interesting question. At this time in his life, what is Joseph looking for? Is he looking for his father's favoritism? Is he looking to achieve his dream? Is he really looking for his brothers? Is he looking to find his brothers doing something wrong? Which would make sense. We don't know the answer to that, but whatever it is that he's looking for, he finds it in a roundabout way, right? He doesn't find it the way that you assume he would. As in every good adventure story, he finds something unexpected and painful on the way to finding something, right, wonderful and triumphant. And that's the story of every story of a journey. When we had to choose a quote, you know, the blocks upstairs for Sinai Akiba, you can choose to put your name on or a quote on or whatever. So the quote that we chose was from Martin Buber. Every journey has destinations of which the traveler is unaware, right? And that is certainly true for Joseph. And remember that Buber translated the Bible into German. Buber spent a great deal of time with the Bible. He and Rosenzweig together, two of the greatest Jewish philosophers of the 20th century, together translated the Bible into German. And the only reason that the translation is not better known is because not long after they finished it, the German Jewish population was destroyed. So there was very little market for the translation once they finished it. But at the time that they did it, Germany was the literary and especially the biblical scholarship language of the world, right? All the greatest Bible scholars spoke and wrote in German, the way that you would in English now if you published a scientific article. Then if you published articles about the Bible, you had to do it in German. So their translation was, it was assumed, going to be the translation of the 20th century, and then of course came World War II and dwarfed any achievement. So, okay. Anyway, so back to the story. He answered, I'm looking for my brothers. Could you tell me where they're pasturing? Now, here's another enigma. He just says, my brothers. How does this guy know who his brothers are? Right? It doesn't seem like he would. So again, several answers are proposed. I mean, the easiest answer is this guy was sent by God. So, you know, this is all basically a setup. God sent this guy. All Joseph has to do is happen upon him, and he's going to send him in the right direction because this is all part of a grand design. And remember that later on in the story, Joseph says to his brothers, God intended all this to happen. So among the many coincidences that Joseph may be thinking of, this could be central among them. I mean, God put this guy right in front of me when I was wandering around on the plains of Shechem. But the other possibility is that the brothers already have a distinctive culture that makes them different from everyone around them. Whether they spoke Hebrew or didn't speak Hebrew, or what kind of Hebrew they spoke, is an interesting question, because the Bible doesn't really say anything about the development of Hebrew itself, right? The rabbis assume that Hebrew is the original language, that Adam and Eve spoke Hebrew. Language scholars tell us that Hebrew developed from other languages that were spoken in the area at the time. So who knows? But remember, it's a tribal world. And in a tribal world, people have different accents and they dress differently. And I read this wonderful book a few years ago in Hebrew called Hacharidim. It's all about the ultra-Orthodox in Israel. And one chapter is about how they dress. And it turns out, like, if you see white on the stockings, it's one group. If you see someone who wears one kind of hat, it's another group. If it's a different kind of hat, it's a different group. If they wear their payas this long, it's one group. If they wear their payas this long, it's another group. And people in that world know instantly what part of the ultra-Orthodox world you're from, whereas people outside the world look and say, oh, look, a black hat Jew. But inside that world, the differences are like real differences. I mean, so much so that, as you may know, they don't always get along with each other. In fact, the best, funniest example of this was the Satmar Rebbe, who really did not like other ultra-Orthodox groups, one in particular that you'll find out in a second. They once asked him, what's the closest religion to Judaism? And he said, Lubavitch. Okay? So you can imagine how he felt about the Lubavitch Hasidim. They don't always get along with each other, but they all understand the code that to someone outside of that world we don't understand. So if this guy lived in that world, he might have realized when Joseph said, my brothers, and he saw how Joseph was dressed or how he spoke or maybe how his hair was cut or wasn't cut, he may have recognized him right away and said, it's got to be these guys. And Joseph made that assumption that other people who are pastoring in the area wouldn't look and act like us. But having said that, it's still a strange way to approach someone you don't know. And instead of saying, did you see 10 guys dressed in, you know, long robes or whatever, to say, did you see my brothers? And this is another thing that gives a sense that Joseph has an awareness of his own destiny. That's why he's asking like this. And he says, the man said to him, they've gone from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And this reinforces the miraculousness of the encounter, because they weren't in the city of Shechem. And this guy happened to hear them say where they were going. So it's not just that he could have found anyone in the city. He had to find this guy who happened to hear them say, I'm going to Dothan. And had he not found him, he would not have found his brothers, and we wouldn't be here. I mean, in theory, you could think that, right? This is one of those crucial moments, a hinge of history, as Thomas Cahill likes to say in his books. This is a hinge of history where if it hadn't happened, it wouldn't, everything would have been different. It's and those sorts of things, they're really true. The pacifistic king of Greece, whose name was Alexander II, I think, he had a pet monkey who bit him, and he died of blood poisoning. And then his successor, who was more bloodthirsty, inveigled them in a war in which 250,000 people died. And later, Churchill said 250,000 people died of that monkey bite. And we don't normally think of it that way, but the truth is very simple things have very ramified consequences. I mean, what, you know, if John Wilkes Booth had missed, the history of the United States probably would have been much better, because Jackson was, in terms of Reconstruction and the South, was very punitive in a way that Lincoln wouldn't have been, at least by every judge. What's that? Johnson, rather, sorry. In a way that Lincoln wouldn't have been, judging by everything that Lincoln said before that. So there are lots of possibilities that things can change in an instant, and the Torah gives us many hints without saying it explicitly that this is one of those cases, since the guy happened to hear, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph followed his brothers and found them at Dothan. Bless you. Now, I don't know this for a fact, but I don't know if he says it. Oh, he does. Good. Dothan is an ancient fortress town, 13 miles northwest of Shechem. So that's a long trip, right? It's not like he would happen upon them. 13 miles is, you know, a journey. Lying in a valley known for its rich pasture land. So it made sense that that's where they would want to go. And I'm assuming that Dothan is not very big if he found them there. But he doesn't say how big Dothan is or where it is. I don't know if anybody knows where Dothan is. I don't. Okay. By the way, the entire journey, Sarna makes one more helpful comment. To Shechem, from where they were, took about 5 days by foot. Okay? Joseph here exhibits a dogged persistence, undoubtedly a quality that later earned him the confidence of his Egyptian masters during captivity. So that's a nice interpretation, but the other possibility, and maybe the more plausible thing, is not just that Joseph has a characteristic of persistence, but that he wants to please his father. His father said, find them. So he wants to find them. He doesn't want to come home having failed and saying, I couldn't find them. Because his father doesn't say, find them if you can, or I understand if you can't. His father just says, find them and bring me back a report, which is what Joseph wants to do. He finds his brothers, of course, and let's just take one or two more verses and then we can have a discussion. They saw him from afar, and before he came close to them, they conspired to kill him. Okay? So sometimes we don't remember, the brothers did not at first plan to sell him into slavery. In fact, later, most of them didn't plan that at all. From the beginning, what they wanted to do was kill him, which is awful, right? I mean, really, so they hated him, so his father favored him, so maybe he was going. Now, remember, last time we talked about a very interesting, involved, if implausible, reason why they wanted to kill him, which was that they felt like he was, they assumed that his dreams were prophetic, that in fact people would bow down to him and that he would be a king, and they knew that kings were bad, and so they were trying to save the original vision of Israel by ensuring that Joseph never became a king, right? They were striking a blow for democracy. It was like killing Caesar. Possible. It's a nice interpretation, but it's a little bit of a stretch. It seems more plausible that they wanted to kill him because they hated him. And they don't by circumstance, not by design. So let's stop there with the brothers poised to kill Joseph, and we'll have to wait till next week to see if they succeed. I suppose you could read ahead. But it is, you know, that Heschel tells that story about the Akedah, that there was a boy in class that every year they would read the Akedah, and he would get scared that Abraham was really going to kill Isaac. And one of the other students said to him, what's the matter with you? We know this story. We know how it comes out. And the teacher said, no, that's exactly how you're supposed to read it. You're supposed to come to the story each time new and feel the fear of it just as they felt, and as if you don't know, and as if at the last moment they're rescued. And the weird thing is, if the story's effective enough, in some ways that works, because if you see a movie 100 times, if the movie's good enough, you still feel, even though you know, right? What's that? The shower scene, exactly, in Psycho. It still feels horrendous even though you know what's going to happen, and even though you know that she lived to make other movies, right? It doesn't matter. It still works. I mean, now how does that happen? I don't know how that happened, but it does. So it's just anyway. Okay, so let's stop there. Questions, comments, yeah. Mm, that's a great, yeah, that makes, I also see you got the gray memo today. exactly, yeah. It does make sense that they were known because of what they had already done in Shechem. And so, although how he knew that Joseph was their brother, I don't know, unless they were some, they had to be somehow distinctive in one way or another. What Sarna says is essentially, look, the Bible doesn't have to give you every bit of dialogue. And Joseph could easily have said, hi, you know, I'm Joseph, son of Israel. Do you know where my brothers are? But yeah, it does make sense that they were known in Shechem. What also puzzles me and is, you know, they left Shechem presumably because their lives were in danger there. So why would they go back unless things calm down very quickly and people just move on? Well, yeah, to some extent. I mean, it depends how far away, but if it's 5 days walking away, then not. But,
or
yeah.
Or at least if they were strangers. They knew a stranger.
Right, they did know a stranger. That's true. But then again, so he would come and he would be a stranger too, and the guy would say, how did he know that the guy was from the area and wasn't also a stranger if he's a stranger, unless there was some distinctive dress? But it's important, what you're saying is important to remind us that we're dealing with a very different world from our world. And we really do live in a world of constant strangers. And that wasn't the ancient world at all. Most people in the ancient world, until the last, I think, really 50 years or so, I don't remember, I read whatever the statistic is, most people never, ever left the town they were born in. It's not that they did it occasionally, which is why so much of early literature and storytelling is about someone who comes to a town or someone who leaves a town, because it was a rare event, whereas now it's every day. So, yeah.
What about if this man overheard them saying that they're going to this other town? What if he had also overheard them saying, we hate our brother, he's wearing this coat of many colors? And like, he had heard this whole...
He heard the story.
...plotting to kill him. So they still have all this anger, and maybe he overheard them talking about all this anger that they have toward this guy, and this guy shows up in this coat of many colors, and they're like, oh, you must be the brother of...
It's certainly possible. I mean, we could invent scenarios where he recognized Joseph even before Joseph introduced himself to him, depending on how much of the conversation he overheard and how much he cared about. And whether the brothers, I mean, whether this was the topic of discussion of the brothers, which it could well have been, since resentments, you know, simmer. And when you're alone and away from the people that you resent, and you're with other people who dislike them, it's a logical topic of conversation. I don't know. I also don't know. I mean, it depends how much were the brothers actually together. If you have 10 people who are pasturing a couple hundred sheep, do they sit together as a group? Are they spread out? Do they, in fact, talk to each other a lot? I don't know. And what are the odds that this guy would overhear the place that they were going to if he wasn't constantly listening to them? I don't know. Yeah.
I'm wondering, why wouldn't Jacob send Joseph with the brothers in the first place?
I don't know. I mean, we speculated, but I don't know. Have any ideas?
No.
I mean, I gave the four reasons why I thought it was possible. One, that he wanted to protect him from them. Two, that he favored him. Three, the brothers didn't want him. Or four, that Joseph didn't want to go. But who knows which one? But then why would he send him later? Right, unless he still thought of Joseph as the person who checks up on them. So just as he had, Joseph came back with reports about Bilhah and Zilpah, because maybe this goes back to Shechem. Maybe Jacob doesn't trust the brothers when they're alone. Because remember, he was upset that they did what they did in Shechem when they killed all these people. So maybe, especially if he heard they went to Shechem, maybe he wanted Joseph to check and make sure they weren't making mischief again, or that they weren't in trouble in Shechem if other people were upset at them. I don't know. It may have been a good intention, just didn't turn out good. Yeah. Yeah.
What's your opinion and the opinion of other rabbis about how entwined God is in the average Jew's life?
Today? How entwined is God in the average Jew's life today? Well, there you get a huge range from people who believe very deeply in what's called Hashgacha Pratit, which is God's direct supervision over each life, to people who are more of the opinion that God's withdrawal from the world, which begins in the Bible, continues, and God gives human beings more and more and more space to create their own destiny. And I would say you can get rabbis of every opinion all along the way. And it's a fascinating theological question for which, if you're really interested in it, especially in the Bible, I suggest to you there's a really wonderful book by Richard Elliot Friedman called The Disappearance of God, in which he traces how through the Bible, God gradually, bit by bit, disappears. And so by the time you get to the last books of the Bible, God doesn't intervene at all, whereas in the first books of the Bible, God's always intervening, which is like the Baal Shem Tov's example of the guy who came to the Baal Shem Tov and said, you know, God, I used to feel God very close, and now I feel very distant from God. And he said, well, that's exactly what God does. It's just like a parent who teaches a child to walk. And how do you teach a child to walk? You move further and further and further away so that the child walks to you. It's now your job to grow closer to God. Yeah. Well, I talk about it as though it's God's design, not what you call synchronicity, the Bible calls God.
I know. Yeah. What I'm saying is that when you open, instead of, from the Enlightenment, we've tried to be logical and all this other thing, is if we don't have this access to another level of unconscious dreams, where you don't have a dream because you want to have a dream, the dreams come from something, you're not in control of that. They come and they unfold, and you're puzzled over them, and there's something worth puzzling there, even though they're not so logical.
So what you're... Okay, so this exact conflict, one of the reasons why I don't want questions going for too long is in part because the microphone doesn't pick them up. So I don't want for there to be too much time of not I was going to say dead air, but that sounds terrible when somebody's actually talking and making an important point. It wasn't dead air in the room, but it may be on the internet. The question, the comment was about synchronicity and opening yourself to non-rational meetings and so on when you travel, etc. And what it reminds me of is, I don't know how many of you saw the New York Times this morning, but apparently in a scientific journal, I'm trying to remember which journal it was, there's a paper that is being published by an emeritus professor at Cornell about ESP, where he did all these experiments with random effects, like is the computer going to flash on the right side of the screen or the left side of the screen, with 1,000 different students at Cornell. And he claims that there is evidence that ESP in the sense of being able to foretell the future, that he can see, which is, by the way, a logical analysis of what you would call synchronicity, that he can see that the incidence is way too high to be coincidence. In fact, they can't. So there's a huge controversy because some scientists are extremely upset that any reputable scientific journal would publish what they consider to be this arrant nonsense. And other scientists say, well, if you did an experiment and the experiment is well done, and there's obviously a dispute about whether the experiment was well done or not, and who knows, because I didn't have time to read the whole article. And even if I did, I wouldn't know without reading the paper. And even then, I wouldn't know because I'm not a scientist. But whether it was well done or not, they say this is certainly, anything can be studied scientifically, and if he let's put it in the in the journal, and we'll argue about it. But this debate about whether synchronicity is conceivable to the scientific mind is endless. So, yeah.
About the plot that you said, four possibilities.
Yes.
Yeah. Possibility that we can insert another theory, and that is Joseph tells his dream to his father. He keeps the matter in mind. Then he sends the son to follow, to go and bring them forth. So, and the son says, Joseph says, here I am.
Right. So in other words, so your idea is that he's sending Joseph to the brothers to see if the dream actually comes true. Let Joseph demonstrate his dream.
Yes, let him demonstrate.
It could be. All,
the brothers know it.
And the brothers know that, and so they want to get rid of him because they fear that Joseph is about to demonstrate his dream. And they unwittingly, as always happens in Greek myth, they unwittingly create the dream in the process of trying to destroy it. Right, just like with Oedipus, right? They try to kill Oedipus, and because they try to kill him, he doesn't recognize his father and mother when he meets them and grows up, and so he kills his father and marries his mother. Could be, it could very well be. I mean, there is certainly that idea that the Bible is showing us the way in which, by trying to destroy Joseph, they actually make what he said come true. Yes, so one, two, three, four. Yeah.
Could you comment on the interesting dichotomy between verse 12, where Jacob says, "Go and see how your brothers are." Well, in Hebrew, it's in how the hashalom, the peace of your brothers, and how they're
doing.
How they're doing peacefully, and then we say.
I mean, it's only odd if you assume that Jacob thinks they're going to greet him peacefully. Yeah, I mean, it's odd that the brothers want to kill him in the first place. It's this, so far we haven't seen anything that suggests that the brothers want to kill him. So they resent him, so they're angry at him. Had you not read the story, though, you wouldn't assume that they're going to kill him, right? That's pretty, I mean, it's their brother. For God's sakes, but they do, yeah.
Almost every parent wants their children to get along. I mean,
yeah.
It's very upsetting that you see this animosity between children. So is it possible that his motive, Jacob's motive, was to send Joseph to make peace with his brothers? And he says, I am ready. Maybe that means I am ready to make peace.
Well, that fits nicely with what you just said about the shalom achicha.
Yeah.
Go see the peace of your brothers. Yes, although if he does that, he's very naive, very naive.
Yeah, but
because you don't send, right, you don't send one kid to another when there's resentment without anything that mitigates the resentment before you do that, right?
Send him alone.
I mean, how often have you seen clueless teachers put two kids who are angry at each other together and say, shake hands, as though that's gonna do anything, right, other than make them resent each other more and hate the teacher. Marcy.
Where was
he's very young, very young. Yeah, he's a little kid.
As I read 18 on, his brothers were intent, first degree murder. They had intent.
Yes.
And they had malice.
Absolutely.
Clearly.
Yes.
Suddenly, I jumped backwards, and I wondered whether Reuben.
Oh, well, wait, we haven't gotten to Reuben yet.
Well, I thought we said that Reuben said you're not going to do this.
We haven't gotten there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, we so far, we've only gotten to the verse that says, let's kill him.
The other one,
so, yeah.
You said that everybody in the neighborhood knew each other. By definition, it says that the man heard the brothers.
Yes.
He understood them.
Right.
He was able to talk to Joseph in a way that Joseph understood. It is possible that the man was sent by Jacob.
So this is kind of an interesting thought. I mean, I assumed that he understood either because they spoke the same language or could speak the same language. So Joseph goes to Shechem and he knows he's got to speak Shechemish. So, which... Yes, exactly. It grew into Flemish, and later is when the vowels soften. But it could. I mean, you're suggesting that maybe this person was sent by Jacob to keep an eye on things. Although, if he does, then why doesn't he go on to Dothan to keep an eye on things better? I mean, it's
the word heard.
Yeah, right. Heard. Yeah. He knew the language and he knew the people, which is, again, I mean, we tried to explain it, but it's curious however you account for it. Yeah.
Is Leah still alive?
Is Leah still alive? Yes, Leah is still alive.
Is there any indication
of any relationship? Doesn't say anything other than their, you know, their resentment, other than the assumption of the brother's resentment. Although it does, when some commentator says something. What is it? I have to remember what it is. I remember reading a commentator that said something about how Leah must then have brought up Benjamin and Joseph because Rachel wasn't there anymore. But I don't remember in what context they talk about it. So I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
So what do we take away from this parsha as we walk out the door for living today?
Well, so... It depends. What do we take away from this parsha as we walk out the door? The first thing that most traditional commentators would say is that you see, even though human beings make choices and things seem arbitrary, it follows God's design. That's the principle. That and the man from Dothan is the illustration of that. I mean, we're a lot less sympathetic to that lesson than Jews used to be, in part because we have greater power to affect our world than people used to, and also because the Holocaust made that a very problematic lesson, right? Those Jews, and by the way, traditional Jews do, those Jews who say that the Holocaust was also God's design, right? Which that's, you know, if you read the aforementioned Satmar Rebbe, that's exactly what he says. He says, why did the Holocaust arise in Germany? What else arose in Germany? Anybody? Reform Judaism and Zionism. He said, there you go. The site of the sin was the site of the punishment, right? So for people who, I mean, that's the lesson. And even though you may not like that lesson, people still use that lesson selectively. So they'll say, okay, the Holocaust wasn't God's design, but the fact that I met this person at this moment in my life was God's design, right? So we do selectively still use God's design when something good happens. Or when something bad happens, people will say, why did God do this? So it's a very powerful lesson that we have a hard time shaking. Because if you shake it, then you have to say God has nothing to do with the world, and that's a hard lesson too. And the second part of this, and by the way, this lesson will get ramified, that is, it'll get complicated and deepened when the brothers want to kill Joseph and he doesn't get killed and he gets sold into slavery, and it all clearly follows this pattern. But the second lesson also is clearly a parenting lesson about how the negative effects of favoritism and obliviousness and all the things that Jacob is guilty of in fostering the anger that the brothers already have against Joseph. And it's probably a little bit a lesson against polygamy too. Since after all, by the time of the rabbis, you know, none of the rabbis are married in the Talmud are married to more than one woman. And yet the Bible does allow polygamy. So, but it always causes problems. Whether on Showtime or in the biblical text, it always causes problems. So, I've actually never seen that show, but I didn't. Is it?
Turning inside up, what if Jacob was telling Joseph, go and see about keys? What he meant was, don't start about dreams and people bowing down to you.
Right, that may have been. When he said, right, go see the peace of your brothers. It may be that he was saying to him, he was warning him, don't start with the dreams all over again. That when he kept the matter in mind, it meant that he was aware that he had to advise Joseph that this is this a problematic way of relating to your brothers. That would certainly make sense. I suppose an interesting thing, I've never thought about this before, is even though Jacob gives Joseph the coat of many colors, you never, at least at the beginning of the story, hear him say anything to Joseph that demonstrates favoritism. He doesn't say to him, "Joseph, my favorite child, go and check on your brothers." He doesn't do that. So another possibility that is sort of percolating in my mind is, you know, a lot of fathers, especially for most of history, are not raised to express verbally how they feel. So what do? You give the kid a coat. And if that's true, that means that the other brothers already weren't getting any kind of verbal encouragement from their father. He doesn't even give it to Joseph. And that would make the wounding of the coat that much greater. Because, yeah. We don't. There are a lot of different translations of what ketonet pasim is. An ornamented tunic is the modern translation. I just say a coat of many colors because that's the name that everybody knows. Whatever, it's some kind of fancy coat, whatever it is. I think Burberry, but I don't. But whatever. Although there's a dispute among the. But whatever it is, it's a token. The point is that it's a token of favoritism. But as you say, it doesn't say colors. Which is why I don't remember how they translate it here. Do they say an ornamented tunic in this translation, or do they say a coat of many colors? Yeah, here they say an ornamented tunic. The precise meaning of ketonet pasim remains unclear. In Samuel, a garment is mentioned as the distinctive dress of virgin daughters of royalty. Josephus describes it as a long-sleeved tunic reaching to the ankle. In Aramaic and Rabbinic Hebrew, pas means the palm of the hand and the sole of the foot. Radak took pasim to mean stripe. The Septuagint and the Vulgate, that is the Greek translation and the Latin translation, which are very early, render the Hebrew as a robe of many colors, which is where we get it from. Ancient Near Eastern art may shed light on the subject. Sorry you asked now, aren't you? may shed some light on the subject. An Egyptian tomb painting. This is kind of neat. This is what makes modern biblical scholarship so interesting, is they know other societies from around the time. From Beni Hassan, who sounds actually like a tailor, from around, or a sushi chef. Beni Hassan, from about 1890 BCE, features a Semitic clan with men and women wearing multicolored tunics draped over one shoulder and reaching below the knees. Another Egyptian tomb has a representation of Syrian ambassadors bringing tribute to Tutankhamun. They're dressed in elaborately designed long robes wrapped around the body and over the shoulders. A mural fresco in the palace of King Zimri Lim at Mauri in southeast Syria shows figures dressed in garments made of many small rectangular panels of multicolored cloth. The discovery of a pas garment in a list of articles of clothing from the town of Ugarit, dated not later than the 13th century BCE, provides a parallel to the biblical phrase, but little clarification. And there you have it, okay? Thank you, we'll see you next week.